Although now The Three Sisters is hailed as one of the greatest plays of the 20th century, early reviewers called it dull and drab, a play beginning nowhere and getting nowhere. Joining us is James Bonin, guest director of the University Theater's production of Chekhov's The Three Sisters, which runs here in Madison until March 17th. Also in the studio with us are two of its cast members, MFA candidates David Wilson Brown and Lea Esperaqueta.
Welcome, one and all, to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, Chekhov, we've already established in a previous conversation last week that Chekhov did pose some difficulties for listeners, viewers, directors, I suppose even actors of his time. But looking at The Three Sisters, where does that fit into Chekhov's playwriting career?
It's the second-to-last play that he wrote. He had such a difficult time getting Uncle Vanya. Well, he started with The Wood Demon, which became Uncle Vanya, and then but that happened. He sort of was forced to do Uncle Vanya because he was so depressed about the response to The Seagull that he decided not to ever write a play again. And then slowly he evolved into – he changed his mind, and in the last 5 years of his life wrote these two masterpieces, Three Sisters and The Cherry Orchard, when he was quite sick with tuberculosis, actually, and living away from Moscow most of the time.
Well, let me ask you, because you've directed a lot of other plays. You've done Shakespeare at American Players Theater and so on. When you turn to Chekhov as a director, what to you is special about Chekhov as a playwright to work with?
I think his humanity, his, like Shakespeare, his non-judgmental quality. He presents these very complicated human beings, and he never says, this is a bad person, this is a good person. He just says, these are people. And I find that very moving and very challenging because he demands of actors that they find the full scope of human complexity. And sometimes, as in the sequence you just heard, I mean, that's basically two people wooing each other.
Well, they're talking about depression, though.
They have that something in common, I guess.
No, and they do have lots in common. But, I mean, that's the wonder of him, is that this scene, which we can hear more of in a little while, is an absolute love scene, even though it's very – they choose to reveal truths about their own lives. And through that revealing, signal to each other that they're each married, by the way, to someone else both in unhappy marriages. The role that Leia plays is the middle sister of the three sisters. And David plays the character named Vershinin, who's the battery commander. The girls were brought up in a military family. Their father was the battery commander of this medium-sized town. Most people think it's based on a town called Perm, which is in the Ural Mountains, 800 miles from Moscow. And you know the famous thing about Three Sisters is the sisters are trying to get to Moscow the whole play.
Kind of like Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of similarities to Waiting for Godot, and if you want to get into that later, we can. I mean, there's no question that there's a strong correlation between those two plays, both in their meaning or their kind of subtlety about hope, but also in just the way that – I mean, the famous – trope about Waiting for Godot is it's the only play where nothing happens twice. And that's a little bit the same issue with Three Sisters. I mean, it isn't a play where there is much action. In fact, all of the action takes place off stage. That's about – what you just heard is about as steamy as it gets.
You have to bring your own steam.
Yeah, I'm afraid, yes, you do. But yet underneath that, there's this profound sort of river of human feeling that's so – and the current gets quite swift, I think.
And how do you do that theatrically, though? How do you bring out that intensity?
Well, you encourage the you try to create a situation where the actors know that there's more than one thing going on, and then you explore ways that when they lie, they're aware that they're lying, or when they, you know, when they want one thing. David, there's a very famous moment in this scene with the very beginning. Well, why don't you guys read the very beginning of the scene when you come in? You know, they've come in from outdoors. There's going to be a big set. It's the night before Lent begins, so it's sort of Fat Tuesday, and they're expecting that there's going to be a party in the room, and they come into the room, and there's nobody in the room, and it's dark. And they've been out in public. Obviously, the whole town knows that they're married to other people. And they come into this room, and suddenly they're in this beautiful, dark parlor with no one around. And so...
Party on.
Party on, exactly.
I don't know. I don't know. Of course, habit can be very strong. For example, after Father died, it took us a long time to get used to the fact that we didn't have orderlies anymore. But I think I'm being fair about it, even allowing for habit. Maybe it's different in other places, but in this town, the most respectable, the best brought up, and the best educated people are in the military.
I'm really thirsty. I'd love a cup of tea.
So, I mean, so Chekhov does two wonderful things there. They come in the middle of an argument. It's a famous Shakespearean device. You know, you start a scene in the middle. Uh-huh. So the actors are – they've been out walking in this cold air of, you know, February, and they're all bundled up. And the very first thing you see is David removing Leia's cloak so that his hands can go close to her neck, you know, and there's that kind of electric – and Leia's eyes kind of – bulge out of her head when that happens. But I mean, but that's how – that's part of the way you do it. I mean, with these little subtle gestures.
Body language.
Yeah, body language is hugely important in this play and the ways that people move through a room. But then she – the very first thing she does in this argument is flatter the men in the military by saying men in the military are much, you know, better people. And he's saying, no, you're just used to people in the military because you grew up in a military family. But what he really says, he takes all of this emotion he's feeling and all of this lust for her and he says, I'd like a cup of tea.
So that doesn't mean that he's not really paying attention to what she's saying. He's kind of speaking another language all of a sudden.
Yeah, my job is to make sure you think that he's not just asking for a cup of tea. but why don't you ask for it three different ways and show – and this and because you can overplay these kinds of things too.
I'm really thirsty. I'd love a cup of tea.
See, and that's kind of – I'd like a cup of tea. Okay, now ask for something else with the tea.
I'm really thirsty. I'd love a cup of tea.
And now just ask for the other thing.
I'm really thirsty. I'd love a cup of tea.
You know, and so that's... Yeah, exactly. And she knows that there's more being asked for than tea. And that's the energy of the way this works. And again, I would argue that one of the things that makes him so remarkable is that he was brave enough to put human behavior on stage. I mean actual human behavior on
the
stage.
Subtext.
Yeah, with lots and lots of undercurrents.
I have to ask, on behalf of all of our listeners, what is her next line?
It ought to be ready in a minute.
Whoa.
Yes. Now, we happen to have a lovely young freshman who's playing the maid in the play and it's not necessarily a line spoken to a maid, but we happen to have the maid on the stage lighting candles to create a little more romance so the maid nods and runs off stage so that the cook knows to bring the tea on.
Well, let me ask you, since this is radio and we can't see the visual side of it, how are you staging it so that as people come into the world of this play and you have to establish that it's a provincial town, that, as you said, Moscow is hundreds of miles away and they're never going to get there and they keep talking about how they want to get there. What are you doing to sort of show the world of this family?
Well, it's – because it's a university production, you know, there are limited resources. Well, everything – I mean, my God, the theater I run in Chicago has enormously limited resources. So you have to kind of be evocative. We have three abstract trees – upstage and then this kind of – these large units and beautiful furniture and rugs that create a kind of – they should create, we hope, a strong sense of a family's home. And it's clearly one of the nicest homes in this town. I mean people flock there in the third – of the famous third act, which takes place in the attic of this house. But there's a fire that's destroyed an entire block close by and people just go to this house. I mean they just – they come here because they feel safe. And so, you know, you get this image of this – the whole downstairs of the house are people just sitting waiting out the fire because the Prozorov house is a safe place. And when Vershinin comes in for the first time, he's known these girls since they were little in Moscow because he knew their father. And they've been in this town when the play starts 11 years, which is a long time to – to be in a road company and not on Broadway. But they create the longing in the first act by, you know, before Vershinin or anyone else comes in, by talking about the fact that they long to go back. And they've romanticized Moscow to the point of absurdity. I mean, David, maybe you should look up that speech that you give in Act Two later on about the man who's in prison. Because, I think the danger, obviously, is something's taken away from you when you were young and it's become this idealized thing.
Sure.
Right. And so they've all idealized Moscow. I mean, Masha has made a mistake that young women make in small towns. I mean, she'd married to get out of her father's – out from underneath. Her father seems to have been a very strict disciplinarian. She marries young to this kind of – a man she's idealized because he's a teacher. And then she realizes – we see her at age 23. She's been married 5 years when the play starts, and she's just miserably unhappy. I mean, her life is in – just stopped. And she sees no – right? I mean, you see no way out of your life. And then this – Joker comes along, David, Vershinin, who talks passionately about life in 300 years and how wonderful it's going to be.
Yes,
and he's doing that because his life now is terrible. He's married to a woman who's would probably be, clinically insane, and he has two young children with this woman. And so he lives in constant fear that his wife will do something to damage his children's lives.
So the good life is either far removed by distance of space or time.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean,
it's
time
never right here.
Like Shakespeare, time is another character in this play. I mean, it's the only play Chekhov wrote that dealt. I mean, almost all of Chekhov's plays deal with one season, one long season, usually
kind of
summer.
An Aristotelian unity.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this play takes place over four and a quarter years. Well, a lot of directors fight about this, either three and three quarters or four and a quarter.
Give or take a couple of months.
But I mean, if you
stretched out.
Yeah, if you think, yeah, I mean, it starts in May, say, of 1898, and it ends in September of 1902.
So the part that we're about to hear that Vershinin is going to say, is this still spoken in the dark hallway or this in a later scene?
Well, it's in the same room, at the same scene, same act, but it's later in the act when there are lots of people around now. And he's heard these ladies talk about Moscow over and over and over again already. I mean, it's – so go ahead and read that.
How wonderful it must be not to know whether it's winter or summer. I think if I lived in Moscow, I wouldn't care what the weather was.
The other day I was reading the diary of that French politician, the one who went to prison because of the Panama scandal. It was so moving the way he described the birds he could see from his prison window, birds he never even noticed when he was a government official. Of course, now that he's out of prison, he probably doesn't notice them anymore. It's the same with you. Once you're actually living in Moscow, you won't notice it anymore either. We're never happy. We can never be happy. We only want to be happy.
That's the theme of the play. One of the themes of the play, obviously, is this wanting but not acting.
Now, isn't the school teacher that she's married to, is he the one that keeps saying he's happy all the time in a very tedious, pedantic kind of way?
Well, except that it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
Oh, my God.
When
it's crushingly heartbreaking because you know he's lying and he knows he's lying and everybody in the room knows he's lying over and over and over again because, the whole town knows that she's having this relationship with this romantic colonel. And, and age is quite important to the colonel. I mean, they're 20 years apart in age. He's in his mid-40s. Masha's in her mid-20s. And that's one of the very first things he mentions about himself is that he's 44 years old. And he knows that time is, if you'll pardon the military pun, marching on in its inexorable way. And, I mean, everybody's aware of time in the play all the
There's
time.
There's a line in there where somebody says, well, in 25 years, this, that, or the other, and somebody comes in and says, yeah, we'll all be dead in 25 years.
Right, right.
In case you get your hopes too high.
No, exactly.
But this set that you have depicted of the house, a comfortable, maybe in later years they'd say bourgeois domicile, but well-furnished and comfortable, and everybody comes to it, and yet it's a place of misery. Everybody there is wretched.
How is
what
that
gives?
How is that so unusual? I can think of many examples of people I know who would say
dysfunctional families in all settings.
I've lived in that house. I mean, we've all lived in that house, and I think that's what really is the that's the real message, is that we're all trapped by time's inexorability or inexorableness, and it's, you know, and what do we do with our time to make it valuable? I mean, the youngest sister, Irina, struggles over and over again. She starts the play with this wonderful pan to work, even though she's never worked a day in her life. And but then the next time we see her, Chekhov never shows her happy at work. He shows her complaining about work because she's discovered that work is difficult. And that what she finally reaches at the end of the play is that she's going to go and become a teacher, because at least a teacher does something that is identifiably valuable. You know, she offers help to other people. And so I think she really learns something very important about the way she wants to live.
There is one interesting, another of those future lines in there. In the future, someone says, everybody will work.
Right, that's Tuzenbach.
Which sounds both Soviet and in terms of today's reality rather true too, and yet they'll still be miserable, of course, the suggestion.
But I do think that, because he writes that he says just before that there's a storm coming, and clearly you didn't have to be part of the upper levels of Russian life to know there was a storm coming. The play was written in 1900. You know, and the first revolution happened 5 years later, and then the sort of fracturous revolution happened in 1917. So, everybody could sense that. And to say nothing of the World War I, in essence, ending old Europe, fracturing all of the social fabric of Europe. So it's, I think there is no question. And obviously, in the Soviet period, that line was sort of brought out of see?
Everybody works.
Everybody must work.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
This is good. Yeah.
We're going to go more into the world of the three sisters when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, visit wpr.org/underwriting.
Sometimes I think what it would be like to start life all over again, and do it deliberately. The life we'd already lived would be a kind of rough draft, and the new one would be a clean copy. And I think each of us would try not to repeat the same mistakes. At least try to arrange a new environment. Find a room like this to live in, with flowers in it and lots of light. I have a wife and two little girls. And my wife is not a well woman. And with one thing and another, if I could start life over again, believe me, I certainly wouldn't get married.
That's a speech by Vershinin in Anton Chekhov's famous play, The Three Sisters. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are the director of the University Theater production of The Three Sisters, which is running now through March 17th, James Boonen, and also two actors. The one you just heard was David Wilson Brown, and also with us is Leah Espericueta. I love that speech about life being a rough draft. If you could just go back and edit it and, get your second or third draft. And that strikes me as a profound kind of statement to make there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful statement. And it's true, but I think everyone can identify with that. But I think it's particularly revealing that Vershinin has only been in the room 5 minutes when he makes this speech. And he's kind of enthralled by the new energy he feels from seeing these women as adults and contrasting it with his own sense of, he doesn't know anything about anyone's life yet. He's just...
He's seen them when they were girls.
Quite young, yes.
Yeah. So he's got this contrast all of a sudden.
Yeah, this startling contrast. And I think that theme of starting his life is never far from his mind. I think he's always wishing... He didn't, because of the choice, he's in his second marriage, and divorce was a very unusual event then. So this is a choice he made, and it turned out to be a disastrous choice.
Well, let's talk about the title, The Three Sisters, because, there's also the brother, but we have three different sisters, different personalities. What draws him to Masha in particular, and how important would you say the different personalities of these three are? What are we supposed to know about each of the women?
The oldest is named Olga. She's 28 when the play begins. Clearly, whether she wanted to or not, when the mother died young, she became the mother figure in the family. She's a teacher. She's been teaching for 4 years when the play begins. She's unhappy with her life. She's never been married and has no prospects of being married. And so she's the only one in the family at this point who's working. The father has died a year ago. The play begins on the anniversary of the father's death. And they're all at sea. They don't. And Irina wakes up, who's the youngest, who's 20 on the day the play begins. And because it's her name day, she thinks a lot about where her life was, and she misses her mother. But she also she's made this wonderful realization that working is the key to life. And then the middle sister, Masha, who's 23 when the play begins, played wonderfully by Leia, very emotionally, which is great. But her life is stopped, dead. So here's this young girl who's 20s, who for the last 11 years, her only real examples have been her sisters of women's choices. And the one has not gotten married and made the choice to work, and she does nothing but complain about her teaching. And the other married young, and she always complains about her miserable marriage. And so Irina somehow finds the hope and excitement, I think, by connecting it to Moscow, by going home to Moscow. They all call Moscow home, even though they've been in this town for 11 years.
I kind of wish Chekhov in the last act had somebody from Moscow come in and say, boy, what a dump that place is.
Well, there are funny things that, I mean, there are, like, and like Shakespeare, Chekhov uses the lesser-known characters to sometimes make little, I mean, there's an aging servant who always is making odd stories about Moscow, you know, where people die of eating too many pancakes. This inexplicable rope that goes all the way across the city. And, you know, and it was in Moscow or St. Petersburg. I mean, he just sort of dismisses it all the time. And the other thing that Chekhov does, which is brilliant, is that he'll have characters on another part of the stage commenting, even though they're not intentionally commenting. I mean, the sisters will go on and on and on about Moscow, and then upstage, you'll hear somebody totally unrelated to the conversation and not listening to that conversation say, what a bunch of nonsense. And that's the music of the play. I mean, so Chekhov deflates all of this grandiose talk, always gets deflated in some
These are
way.
Characters in the play?
Yeah. There's a doctor.
Almost like a Greek chorus effect?
Yeah. In a way, it is a kind of choric effect, yeah. And I think if you don't get that that's what's happening, the play doesn't have the same or the right sort of tension in it. But it happens over and over again in the play.
With Masha, do you think her misery in her marriage to this school teacher, is it borne out by the character of the school teacher? In other words, do we see what it is that has made her miserable and that makes her turn to a lover? Because you said it was heartbreaking.
I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah.
He's not a bad man at all, and she knows he's not a bad man. In fact, let's listen to this famous Act Two scene, which is a subterranean wooing scene, and hear Masha's reveal about her husband, because she makes a very important distinction early on about that he's not a bad man, and I think that's important.
I don't know. Of course, habit can be very strong. For example, after Father died, it took us a long time to get used to the fact that we didn't have orderlies anymore. But I think I'm being fair about it, even allowing for habit. Maybe it's different in other places, but in this town, the most respectable, the best brought up, and the best educated people are in the military.
I'm really thirsty. I'd love a cup of tea.
It ought to be ready in a minute. I got married when I was 18, and I was afraid of my husband because he was a teacher and I was barely out of school. I used to think he was terribly wise, intelligent and important. Now I've changed my mind, unfortunately.
Yes, well.
Oh, I don't mean my husband. I've gotten used to him. But most of the people in this town are so vulgar, so unpleasant, so stupid. Vulgarity upsets me. It wounds me. I get physically sick when I see someone who lacks finesse, who lacks kindness and gentleness. When I have to spend time with my husband's colleagues from the high school, it makes me sick.
Well, I don't see that much difference, though, between military and civilians, in this town at least. They both seem uninteresting. They're all alike. Listen to any one of the locals who claims to be sensitive or intelligent. civilian or military. His wife depresses him. His house depresses him. Everything he owns depresses him. We are all supposed to be such highly developed abstract thinkers, but why are our lives so depressing? Why?
Why?
Why does his wife depress him? And his children? And why do they get depressed by him?
You're a bit depressed yourself today.
Maybe. I didn't have lunch today. I haven't eaten a thing since this morning. My daughter wasn't feeling well, and whenever something is a matter with my two little girls, I always get very upset. It kills me to think of the mother they've got. God, you should have seen her this morning. What a fool she is. We started fighting at 7 this morning, and at 9 I slammed the door and left. I never talk about these things. It's funny. You're the only one I complain to about it. Don't be angry with me. You're absolutely all I've got.
Listen to the noise in the chimney. Just before Father died, the wind made a noise in the chimney just like that.
Are you superstitious?
Yes.
That's strange. You're a strange, wonderful woman. Strange and wonderful. I can see your eyes shining in the dark.
There's more light over here.
I love you. I love you. I love your eyes. The way you move, I dream about you. You strange, wonderful woman.
When you talk to me that way, it makes me laugh somehow, even though it terrifies me. Don't say it again, please. No, go on, say it. What difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference. Someone's coming. Talk about something else.
And then another couple come in. The younger sister and her suitor come in. But that last moment, I mean, that encapsulates all of her struggle. She wants him to say those things. It scares her when he says them. And then the last line is, it doesn't make any difference because we're both stuck in these marriages, and we're obviously not going to get out of our marriages.
We're not going to go to Moscow. Get out of our marriages.
Yeah. I mean, so what do we do? And then you sort of feel that they don't. That, you know, another 2 years elapse before the third act, and then you feel that the third act is when they finally become lovers.
And what to you makes this quintessentially Russian, besides just sort of geographic place name that are referred to? Is there anything about it that feels that way to you?
Well, at least from what I've read and watched, and I've showed the cast a wonderful Russian film called The Unfinished Piece for Mechanical Piano, which is based on some of Chekhov's short stories and a bit of the character Platonov from an early play. But I think the wild emotional swings in the play and the ways that the Russian character, you know, people can laugh outrageously one moment and then be in tears 5 seconds later. I mean, they don't seem to live in the middle very comfortably. They live one end of the emotional scale or the other. And it causes, you know, a lot of, I think, earned laughter from an audience because the behavior is just bigger in some ways. And it also is very, very compassionate storytelling, which, again, to me is a very, at least in the kinds of writers in Chekhov's sort of line of writers in Russian literature, Turgenev and those people, there's a tremendous sense of compassion, I think, and it's very powerful.
Well, I also hear echoes during his speech of a couple of great Russian situations. I mean, in Anna Karenina, Karenin, he's an okay guy, but he's just kind of boring.
Right.
And Anna inevitably takes up with the military man, Vronsky,
right,
to a bad end, of course. And then he's also complaining a little bit about his health. And I'm hearing Dostoevsky at the beginning of, you know, Notes from the Underground.
Yeah,
I am a sick man. I think my liver is gone. And
right,
that kind of sounded very Russian to me.
Yeah.
How much is it a thing of the turn of the century? I mean, it makes me think a little bit of Ibsen, for example, mm-hmm, and certainly Flaubert, and
a lot of
that in the air then, it seems.
Yeah, there was a huge amount of that in the air. But I do think he was certainly aware of Ibsen. But again, when you go back and you read Ibsen's plays, even in a good translation these days, most of them feel pretty creaky and melodramatic. You know, that where the points are sort of right on the nose.
You mean like the slam door?
It certainly doesn't have the subtlety that
no,
this is.
Yeah, it has no subtlety or not the kind of subtlety that Chekhov asks for, both in the playing and in the listening and in the stories. Well, it's one of the reasons that some audiences didn't get these plays.
Was it just reading it too literally?
Yeah.
Just the surface words and not the subtext.
They just feel like there's no action in these plays. Why doesn't anything happen?
Well, of course, people would say the same thing about Henry James. Nobody gets shot. What gives?
Exactly, right. And Shaw, too. I mean, frequently, Shaw created the sort of – Shaw based his work on the Ibsen model, but then he wanted to create these argumentative dialogues in his plays. And so he created the plays based on arguing. And there's lovely scenes of arguing in Chekhov as well, but it's always about the need for something else. You know, you're arguing. Vershinin argues all the time as a way of impressing Masha. It's the way we do all of our things. You know, it's always about some juice we're getting from somebody that keeps us going.
What do you think of Chekhov's view of women? I mean, Ibsen got in trouble in some ways for making Nora in A Doll's House so outspoken. In The Three Sisters, you have obviously three very unfulfilled women in many ways, three women who share with us what they're not getting. Mm-hmm. But is it in any way revolutionary for its time in terms of ideas about women's place?
That's a great question. I don't know if it was revolutionary. It was certainly, I think, one of the great things about Masha is how outspoken she is about her needs and about her wants. I think that if you look at a brilliant play of Shaw's like Candida, where what's revolutionary in that play is that Candida pushes the borders of a marriage. And the joke about a play like that is that August Strindberg would have written the next act. I mean, there's this tension about women on the cusp of the 20th century yearning for more. I'm not sure that that's in Chekhov's plays other than subliminally.
It seems to be everybody here.
Well, they're all longing for a better life, but I don't think they're not really asking. You never feel like they're saying, I demand that I make the choices.
Except that you've got these three sisters and then the brother and his awful wife who are, and then the wife, because she's, got the household, then is deciding what room they're going to have to move to. So just the way it seems to me that, let's say in Pride and Prejudice, the Bennets are going to lose their house because it's going to go to the male cousin. There is this sort of undercurrent, it seems to me, that these three sisters are going to be moved around like chess pieces if they're not careful.
Oh, there's no question that they are moved around. The third act is intentionally that scene where you see them, the two of them living in the attic together as adult women. I mean, it's heartbreaking. And I think Chekhov was deeply sympathetic to – he was married to a fiery actress, Olga Knepper. I mean, he was aware of all of that push, but I just meant that he wasn't polemic in the way that Shaw was polemic about women's rights, that he just presents the issue. And then he gives them these extraordinary speeches at the end of the play that are all filled with hope after all the loss they've had. And so I think that's really a statement about the spirit of women, if you want to make it into a political statement, the fact that they could have been repeatedly disappointed in the play and smacked down and abused sometimes by a woman in the play. And yet those last three speeches are interwoven and they're connected to each other's thoughts and to the thoughts that Vershinin had during the play and to the thoughts that Tusenbach had in the play, and the women make them their own. And it's about going on, which brings us right back to Beckett with, this sort of startling sense of, I can't go on, I'll go on. The role of hope in this play is profound.
We're going to look at just how the hope does come through and what obstacles there are along the way as the play comes to its conclusion when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
PortalWisconsin.org lists almost 1,000 cultural events in Wisconsin. Find out which ones you want to see at PortalWisconsin.org. Portal Wisconsin is a service of Wisconsin Public Radio and the other partners in the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin.
Well, everything comes to an end. Now it's time to say goodbye. The town gave us a sort of farewell lunch, champagne. The mayor made a speech. I ate and listened, but my heart was here. I kept thinking of you. I'm going to miss this place.
Do you think we'll ever see each other again?
Probably not. My wife and my two little girls will stay on another month or so. If they need any help, do you think you could...
Yes, of course. Don't worry. Tomorrow there won't be a single military man left in town. It will all be a memory. And of course for us it will be the beginning of a new life. Things never work out the way we want them to. I didn't want to be headmistress, but here I am. Headmistress. And of course I'll never get to Moscow.
Well, thank you for everything. Forgive me if things were... I talked a lot, too much, I know. Forgive me for that, too. And don't think badly of me.
Why doesn't that Masha hurry up?
What else can I tell you by way of farewell? Shall we talk a little more? Life isn't easy. Sometimes it must seem stupid and hopeless. But we have to remember that it is getting constantly brighter and better. And I don't think the time is far off when it will be completely bright. I've really got to go. Mankind is passionately seeking something, and eventually we'll find it. I just hope we find it soon. We must find a way to join love of work to love of higher things, mustn't we? Well, now I must go.
Here she comes.
David Wilson Brown as Vershinin and Lea Espericueta as Olga in that scene from Act 4 of The Three Sisters, the great play by Anton Chekhov. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, also with us during this hour, the director of the production of The Three Sisters at the University Theater, James Bonin. And we've been talking about hope and the loss of hope, and here we have some shining through in what looks like a pretty hopeless situation for these two lovers.
It's extraordinary, really. I mean, now remember that Lea was reading the part that she's not playing. She was reading the oldest sister, Olga, and she's about to, Masha's about to make her entrance for the lovers to say goodbye, and they know they'll never see each other again. And what's, I think, most extraordinary about it is that Chekhov gives Masha one word in the goodbye sequence, and it's the word goodbye. It's all done with body language and with the energy of the farewell kiss and all of those things. I mean, so her whole life is summed up in this last embrace, which is a very, very famous moment in the play. But what's extraordinary about the scene we just read is that, and certainly the way that Olivia Dawson is the actress playing Olga, and Olivia is the spinster school teacher, to use a sort of conventional term to describe her, but she has this profound aching love that's totally unrequited, of course, for Vershinin. And what's startling about what David is discovering is that, you know, Vershinin realizes that love in this conversation. And so I would argue that these last few things that David says to her are really a way of valuing her and giving her her full due as a woman and, in essence, saying, I'm sorry about that, too.
The hope, though, let me see if I can avoid putting too fine a point on it, though. The hope is not in what he literally says, because everything in this play so far has been about, say what you will, it's all hopeless. We won't go to Moscow. You know, we're not going to live into this wonderful future 25 or 300 years from now. But the hope, in a sense, is in this false hope that he's giving, or consolation, if you want to call it that for a better term, whether he really believes it literally or not, that things will be better, there will be a shinier future.
Well, and don't you think, I mean, that's one of the ways people use hope.
Absolutely.
As if their life is awful, they have, in order to keep going, they have to make that jump to say, well, either in the next life religiously or in the, you know, after I'm gone years and years from now, the work I do will pay off. It'll give significance to your own life. And I love that this, the last thing that, read it again, David, we must find a way, that the very last thing at the bottom of page 88.
We must find a way to join love of work to love of higher things, mustn't we?
And you know, so he takes this whole idea of work that's gone through the play, and this whole idea of aspiring to something, and conjoins them in the last. You know, right. The
that's
last
a time. Russian theme too. Again, you know, I'm thinking of Anna Karenina and this wonderful, long, expansive scene with Lyovan out there with his scythe, and as an owner working like a peasant, he realizes that he loves this physical work.
Right. Tolstoy, I don't think, cared much for Three Sisters, by the way. He and Chekhov fought a lot about the way they saw the world.
Well, I'm reminded of the fortune I had at a Chinese restaurant that said, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Sure.
Which is kind of what they're doing.
Well, I grew up with the famous Irish aphorism, the situation is hopeless, but not serious.
And I guess all the way through you have this sense of endurance that becomes heroic simply because you're going on.
Yeah.
And running through it, you mentioned Vershinin's wife. There are a couple of references, I think, to the fact that she's about to poison herself.
Right.
So that in the background is this sense of not going on or not putting up with.
Or the threat of not going on. Yeah, because the very first thing you hear about her is Tusenbach's statement. Well, she seems to try to kill herself every now and then just to get his attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And
so it's another kind of going on in a sense. Well, she'll...
Right.
Keep
She'll
on doing her
do
thing,
this,
which is her suicide attempts, serious or not.
And he has to – Vershinin, speaking to the older sister of the woman he's had an affair with, has to ask her, the older sister, to take care of his own wife and children because they're staying on for a month. I mean, it's a very painful exchange. And, of course, he has that wonderful sentence, don't think badly of me, you know, where he asks her, I know I've made decisions – that probably made you ethically and morally uncomfortable, but and it's in the third act when Masha reveals her love. Do you want to do that? Maybe is that too much of a jump backwards in the play to do that? I mean, you know, when Masha tries to contextualize her love, you know, she really when she confesses the love, it's about how, you know, the struggle that she had with it.
Oh, Olga, you're the silly one. I'm in love. It's fate, I guess. I mean, it's just my luck. And he loves me. It's all so funny. Don't you think so? Doesn't it strike you funny? Oh, my darling, we'll get through life somehow, no matter what happens to us. When you read about these things in books, it all seems terribly silly and predictable, but when you fall in love yourself, you realize... Nobody knows anything about it. Everyone has to figure it out for herself. My dear sisters, there, I've told you. Now I will never say another word about it. The rest is silence.
And just as a side, I mean, it's a
nice line.
It's a brilliant speech. But in almost all the translations of this play into English, Chekhov used a line from a Gogol short story there, Diary of a Madman. Mm-hmm. But Paul Schmidt chose the famous last words that come out of Hamlet's mouth as a way of, you know, showing their erudition, but also, you know, finding a way for an American audience to get what's being
well,
said.
Well, that's another aspect of translation as a sort of a cultural translation rather than just the literal.
Does Masha know at this point that Olga is also in love with Vershinin?
No.
Okay, because I was going to say
there's
almost
hints, there's hints of it afterwards. Yeah, no, not at all. There's hints of it afterwards, but... No.
Because it's as if she's saying, you'd have to be in love to know what it's like. But to say that to this older sister that's never had that opportunity, you know, there's a pathos there as well.
And I would argue that a lot of actresses who play Olga don't play it that they're in love with Vershinin. But I just think that Olivia made a great choice because it just thickens the soup a lot.
Is there anything particularly important about the doctor in this play, since Chekhov is a doctor himself?
God. That's a whole other program.
Okay, forget that. Drop that question.
No.
And what
but,
was
I mean,
the little?
The doctor,
there was some little bit you wanted him to read to. Which character?
He's going to read the doctor at the end, so we can talk. You know, but the doctor is Yes, Chekhov was a doctor. The doctor in the play is a father figure because he's 60 years old when the play begins. He was in love with the girl's mother. We never know whether it was requited. Some people suggest that maybe Irina is his daughter. He has a very, very close relationship with Irina. We're playing it simply that Irina reminds, you know, she's the one, the girl in the family who looks like the mother. And so he's just always reminded of the mother when he looks at Irina. It's a difficult, difficult role because he has wild mood swings in the play and strings and springs too. But he is the sort of counter voice in the play frequently, including the very end of the play. And the fourth act, Chekhov in this odd stage direction says the doctor's happy throughout this act, even though he participates in a duel. You know, he officiates over the killing of Irina's husband-to-be, and he keeps repeating this same song, the tarara boom dire, it's going to rain today, which in Russian at that time frequently was a sort of derogatory song sung in brothels. But I prefer to think of it as kind of tying it in with that shattering ending of Twelfth Night, which is one of the funniest and saddest plays in the world. But that play ends with a song by Shakespeare called The Rain, It Raineth Every Day. And I think that that's a part of what the cycle of life. All these great writers were all about cyclical nature of things. I mean, there's all four seasons are represented in Three Sisters, and time and the sense that it rains every day somewhere in somebody's life. And that's sometimes that's devastating, and sometimes it's calming, and sometimes it's something else. It's just not an accident that that song exists. I mean, Chekhov's love of Shakespeare was just profound. But, I mean, all of this stuff, to me, is so deeply humane because people are just trying to accept the mistakes they make and the things that they do and why they figure out why they do them, and no one ever really knows. And we won't have answers. All you have at the end is this kind of sense of we're going to go on.
One of the questions that Chekhov raises, and I think I've seen him do this in at least one other play too, as a sort of an implied self-evaluation. There's a passage in there where I can't remember if it was Vershinin or another character who says, "Well, we don't know who's going to be important in the future." Mm-hmm. That, you know, somebody who we think of as a total fool is going to be thought of as just a great oracle in the future, and we just have no way of knowing how our lives will be evaluated.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's actually said in the first act by Vershinin, and I think it's absolutely true.
And as the play comes to a close, what are some of the final moments that you think make it special?
Well, Masha has fallen in love for the first time in her life and is now having this love taken away forever. And she sees no prospect of her life ever changing. She'll be in this town. She's married to a school teacher in this town. Her younger sister, Irina, has just lost her fiancé in a duel and who's going away tomorrow to teach school. And her older sister, Olya, who has never even been kissed probably in her life, has also had this disappointment of the man that Masha was in love with, yearning for him. But in addition, she's now become headmistress of the school, a job she didn't want, didn't seek, but has accepted because she knows she's now 32 years old. And what is she going to do, go to Moscow and start a new life? That's just not going to happen. So they've each had these devastating things happen in the course of the play. And remember, again, the play takes place over 4 years of people's lives. So there's a huge amount of stuff that happens that we just hear about, that the actors have to convey. But so what happens at the end of the play is the three sisters end up standing next to each other and consoling each other. And it begins, and Leah will be kind enough to read all three of the speeches. I've mentioned who's playing Olga. The young sister, Irina, is being played by Vera Varmalov. But so Masha has the first speech. And I should say that the music they're referring to is the march of the soldiers leaving across the river. And frequently that march was the same thing. It's a sort of martial version of Tarara Boumdie. And then also sitting on stage is the doctor, who has the second to last words in the play, and you'll hear them, and then we can talk about them. So first Masha speaks, and then I'll let you know when the other two start to speak.
Oh, listen to the music. They're going away. One of them has already gone away for good. We're alone. And now we have to start our lives all over again. We have to go on living.
And Irina picks up that theme?
Someday, everyone will know what this is all about, all this suffering. It won't be a mystery anymore. But until then, we have to go on living and working. Just keep on working. I'll go away tomorrow by myself. I'll teach school and devote my whole life to people who may need it. It's autumn. Winter will come. The snow will fall. And I will go on working and working.
And then Olga says,
the music sounds so happy, so positive. It makes you want to live. Oh, dear God. The day will come when we'll go away forever, too. People will forget all about us. They'll forget what we looked like and what our voices sounded like and how many of us there were. But our suffering will turn to joy for the people who lived after us. Their lives will be happy and peaceful, and they'll remember us kindly and bless us. My dears, my dear sisters, life isn't over yet. We'll go on living. The music sounds so happy, so joyful. It almost seems as if a minute more, and we know why we live, why we suffer. If only we knew. If only we knew.
Ta-ra-ra boom deray. It's gonna rain today. What difference does it make?
If only we knew.
What difference does it make?
If only we knew.
Well, we know a lot more about the Three Sisters now, thanks to your visit during this past hour. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in your final weekend of performance at the University Theater. We'll have a link to your website
if
on
you
ours.
Go to our website at WPR.org. You can find out more about the University Theater production of Chekhov's The Three Sisters. Our guests have been the director of the production, James Bonin, as well as two of the cast members, David Wilson Brown and Leia Espiriquata. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Join us for the next hour of University of the Air.